26-221, State of Ohio versus John Grant Gillard. Mr. Benza.
I should say we are expecting this.
Oh, good.
Excuse me.
Good morning.
The fact that the morning of the crime, John Gillard was not arrested, but the
manufacturer of the shell casing stop at the scene, but according to the FBI, he also had extraction marks on them that matched the extraction marks on the shells that had been stopped at the scene. The only way that would have happened was if that bullet had in fact been in the gun that was used at the scene of the crime.
That was the record that we reviewed, that I specifically reviewed when I wrote the case that remanded it back to the trial court now, or the court of appeals. Now, the interesting thing about that is that that was never raised on the first appeal here.
That's correct.
And we, I don't mean to say to go out of our way because it's our job to do that, but we really went pretty far with the defendant in this case to give him not just a second shot, but a third shot.
Yes, you did.
Let's not use shots in this case. To give him a second and a third chance.
That's correct.
And we had an internal debate about that, and most of the judges felt very strongly about it, so we sent it back. But we also sent it back on a limited remand for that purpose to be looked at, and it was. How can we now again say that we can second guess what a trial court found when the trial court was there and we gave him specific instructions on how to determine whether that conflict was there? And isn't that what they've done?
That's correct. That is what the trial court has done. This court has an obligation to review the facts that were found by the trial court, but then apply those facts to the law. And this court has an obligation to conduct an de novo review of the application of the facts found by the trial court to the application of the law. And the law is very clear on this situation. The only determination the trial court had to make was whether or not there was, in fact, an actual conflict of interest.
Do you want us to reweigh the evidence?
No, it is not a reweigh. It's an application of the facts determined by the trial court, unless, of course, those facts are not supported for abuse of discretion, which in some instances they are.
Okay, so now you're saying the facts and abuse of discretion, isn't that a weighing of the evidence, and doesn't 292905 say in part that we're to review this case, death penalty cases, as we do any other criminal case?
That's correct.
And we would not, pursuant to the statute, reweigh the evidence in any other criminal case. We did that once in this case because we, with abundance of caution.
That's correct. The reweighing of the evidence that occurred in this case is the evidence that was presented at the remand hearing. The evidence, in fact, presented at the remand and the application of that to the law is the issue before this court. This issue has never before been considered. This court recognized in the second opinion of Miller that the issue is the existence of the actual conflict. Yes, the facts that were argued and show the actual conflict were presented to the jury at trial, and in my evaluation were not properly argued by defense counsel. But the application of those facts to the conflict of interest issue is what it came for.
Did the public defender represent him at the rehearing, at the hearing on the conflict of interest?
Yes, he did.
And you had the opportunity at that hearing then to raise these same arguments you're presenting now to the trial judge. All
yes.
of the evidence concerning Bill, all of the items you claim the defense failed to properly present, why you think he failed to, and the court was able to look at all of those and look at the witnesses and judge on that issue.
That's correct. And if you look at the trial court's opinion, what the trial court did was go a step beyond the actual conflict of interest issue and actually evaluate the merits of the defenses that were presented to it. The court determined at the remand hearing that the alibi defense that was presented was the strongest defense possible. That, however, is an incorrect application of the law. The issue that this court specifically found to be determined was the existence of the actual conflict, not whether or not Lou Martin has provided the effective assistance of counsel. The other errors that the trial court considered is that it considered the alibi defense that was offered to be inconsistent with the defense that William Gillard was the substantive defendant. Those defenses are not mutually exclusive, they are not inconsistent. This court is well aware. The alibi defense simply says that the defendant wasn't present at the time. Now, there's no denying that two people were murdered this night and one person was gravely wounded. Somebody had to have done that. If you're presenting to the jury the argument that my client was not there, he was someplace else, and as the defense attorney, you have the ability to identify another person who could have committed this crime, you have the obligation to do that. It's the defense attorney's obligation to create reasonable doubt, to point out the inconsistencies in the evidence. And in this case, Louis Martinez was unable to do that because the person who was the substitute defendant was also his client.
Well, could his client have been harmed by his taking that position? Could Bill have been harmed since Bill had already pled?
As the evidence later shows in this case, Bill eventually was harmed because he was further indicted in the same capital charges that John faced. At the time, the grand jury was still investigating. The prosecutor was very forthright, the defense attorney pointed that out, that William Gillis was still under investigation. At that point, Rudy must have recognized that he had a dual obligation. In fact, we know from the testimony of Don Edwards at the remand hearing that they knew there was a problem almost from the very beginning, and they identified the physical evidence that was indicated in this case and where it all pointed to. Louis specifically told Don that he realized that he was probably going to get into trouble trying to get these two defenses. And in fact, he has gotten into trouble because he ended up trying to represent two clients and sacrifice the rights of John Gillis in order to try and protect William.
How do you negate Postlewaite's testimony? I mean, here's one of the victims who lies in front of somebody trying to protect another victim, has his, as I recall, his head jerked back by the pulling of his hair, looking right into his assailant's face, the defendant, who then shoots him and doesn't kill him. Now, how do you get around that kind of evidence?
There was a number of things that were presented at the trial that could have been utilized if or not. But one of the things was there were photographs available that were admitted into evidence that we never argued that showed the physical resemblance between John Gillis and William Gillis. There could have been very easily a misidentification. That was part of the argument that Blue Marcus tried to advance. Without pointing to the specific individuals that misidentification had pointed to.
But these people were all, quote, friends. They were partying until 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning, and Postlewaite knew those people.
Actually, his testimony was that he had only seen John Gillis on one other occasion, and only seen Bill Gillis a few times before that. Bill Gillis and John Gillis were not part of the Fast Times motorcycle gang that Postlewaite and Hendricks and the rest of the members at that house were. John Gillis was not at the party that night, that William Gillis showed up later that night, and that was really the only time that any of them had any involvement. And so the argument could have been made, and I think it was strongly made that Bill John Gillis was not present at that crime, and there was a misidentification. The problem is that you're struggling with, Postlewaite did identify John Gillis as the actual shooter. If Louis Martinez had not been affected by the conflict, he could have said, look at the misidentification, you saw William Gillis. Look at how similar he is to John Gillis. Look at the physical evidence in this case. The closing argument that should have been made on John's behalf was never made, which is simply to stand up and say, look at the evidence in this case. Yes, Brock Postlewaite says that John Gillis did it, but you saw William Gillis. You saw how close and similar he is.
I mean, how is this in the record? You're telling us a theory that might have been a strategically or most likely defense. That's our issue. And yet, to accept this as possibly the most likely defense, we have to know that these two men look so similar that it would have obviated the identification by the victim. So, how are we going to know that? Are we going to just be supposing?
There were photographs that were made of both William and John Gillis in the trial. Also, John Gillis and William Gillis both testified. So the conclusions that could have been drawn from that were obvious to the jury. That evidence was in front of the jury. The issue, again, is whether or not the conflict prevented the markets from presenting that trial, from presenting the substitute defendant defense. It's not whether or not that defense, in fact, would have been.
Well, the first issue is whether the conflict is actual.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. And then the next question is whether or not that prevented.
And I think that they're so closely connected that they're almost inseparable.
But that argument could have backfired also because the two being brothers, if you put Bill firmly at the scene, the probability they're higher than John was. They're also, they both were involved in prior incidents. They were both at the party. They both fled the, one fled the state, one fled the scene. I mean, Martinez could have easily said, hey, I increase the chances of putting my client there, especially with Postlewaite's identification, if I make that argument. So, you're making some leaps of judgment that it may have worked.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. And that's one of the problems that we face in this case. And that's one of the problems that we always face in conflict of interest coming back after the fact. Louis Martinez suffered a stroke several years ago and is not available for testimony. We have no idea why he made the choices that he made. The problem with it is that the conflict of interest that is apparent that did exist in there, at least the potential, this court recognizes the potential for a conflict, is what we can't go then back and say, how would Louis Marquez have done it if he had it? How would another defense attorney have run the case differently? That analysis is not the analysis that is subject to enact the actual conflict of interest issue. The issue is whether or not, as this court recognized in State versus Madras, whether or not the right and the duty of the attorney to represent one client required him to sacrifice his obligation to another client. And the fact of the matter is that there was a viable defense that was not presented on behalf of John Gillard in this trial. And the reason for it appears to be simply that the attorney who represented John Gillard also represented William Gillard, who was the subject of the alternative defense.
But didn't, at the point that the court made its inquiry, the attorney quit representing Bill, and Bill then had separate counsel appointed, so at the point from there on forward, he no longer was representing Bill?
Separate counsel was appointed at the trial. The separate counsel from the Stark County Public Defender's Office was appointed simply to represent William Gillard's interest in the Fifth Amendment. The trial court did exactly what it should have done.
Do you have any evidence that Martinez continued to represent Bill on the anything else?
On the basis of the record, Martinez continued to state that I represent this man, I will always represent this man. And Professor Kirkwood identified that the ethical rules obligate you to protect your client. Even if you give up for the representation of your client, you're still obligated to protect that client and protect the attorney-client privilege. Information that he may have received from William Gillard could never be used against John Gillard or for John Gillard because it had been received from another client without the waiver both by John Gillard and by William Gillard. The trial court should be commended for conducting the hearing that they did at the trial in this case. William Gillard does have, and did have, the Fifth Amendment right that he needed to be investigated and protected. The problem is that the court decided to have the hearing that they did, they neglected to hold the Sixth Amendment hearing that John Gillard was affected. If that hearing would have been conducted, we would be in a totally different position at this time in this case. But the fact of the matter is, it did not conduct it. We are now subject to going back to 1997, go back to what happened in 1985, and trying to evaluate what was the impact of representing both Bill Gillard and John Gillard in the same capital trial. The fact of the matter is that based on the evidence that was available, the implication is that William Gillard had a right to be represented and had an attorney to protect his interests. John Gillard also had an attorney to try to protect his interests. The problem is those interests conflicted, and Louis Marquez was the one attorney that was representing both of those men trying to protect those conflicts.
Thank you, Mr. Benza. Mr. Caldwell.
Bill, even after that initial hearing in Tyler?
He does say on the record that he is representing control of the building.
So then wouldn't it make sense that he would not watch between Bill on the stand and eliciting from Bill all sorts of damaging information about Bill being there and Bill having spent casing and Bill fleeing and Bill giving him false identification? Because it happened, a lot of stuff that points to Bill, and none of that came out. And if he continues to represent him, there's good reason he's not going to have it come out, because he doesn't want to backfire later on against Bill.
Well, actually, all this evidence does come out. The circumstantial evidence that does point to William Gill being there at the time of the shooting.
But not the Martinet that comes out from the other people.
That's right, in the state's case in chief. Again, it's important to understand and to remember Postlewaite's testimony, which is crucial in this case. He testifies that he hears this gunshot, these gunshots outside of the house, sometime after the party's ended. He looks out and he says he sees William Gill out there firing a gun. At that point in time, he tries to wake up Leroy Hansen. He was unable to do so. He then goes to his fiancée, who's passed out on the couch in another room. At that point in time, he hears the door being kicked in, and I believe he describes what he heard as a herd, sounded like a herd of people or cattle coming in. So when multiple people were rushing the house, shortly thereafter, in a matter of seconds, he hears a gunshot, which he assumes was the shot of Leroy Hansen. At that point in time, he decides to throw his body on his fiancée to protect her. The next thing he knows, his head's being jerked back. He looks right in the face of the person who did that, which is the appellant. And he's shot, thrown to the ground, and watches the appellant shoot his fiancée to death. So we know that there were more than one person in the house. In fact, Postlewaite also says he's Anderson's before the park, stick his head into the room to look at what's going on. So the state's theory of trying to present whatever evidence we have to put any of these men in the house and thereby link the whole group by showing that any one of them was there.
But that still doesn't obviate the fact that if, in fact, Martinez is still representing both during the trial, he ain't going to do a darn thing to try to put Bill in there. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
So isn't that an inherent conflict in and of itself, whether it affected the trial or not? That's an inherent conflict?
Well, no, that's not what the trial court found. You know, and the trial court's reasoning was that the Gillard were pursuing a common defense, a joint defense. It's important to look at what evidence was presented to the state hand in which Mr. Martinez had to confront. We had the evidence of the appellant's guilt, which was not only Ron Postlewaite's testimony, but also Ron Webb, the individual from West Virginia, who testified that the appellant told him that his brother was taking the fall for the murders that he actually committed. And you also had evidence that several days before the shooting, the appellant was at a bar in Canton and fired a gun. The bullet from that shooting was extracted and was compared by an FBI agent to the bullets that were extracted from the victims in this case. He concluded that the bullets were all fired from the same gun to the exclusion of any other firearm. So you have this evidence linking the appellant. What's going to be the defense that Mr. Martinez is going to pursue? Well, first is alibi that Mr. Gilbert was not there at the time of the shootings. But he's going to have to do something more than just merely say he's not there. He's got Ron Postlewaite's testimony to deal with. And Postlewaite is familiar with the Gilbert brothers. It's not a stranger situation that he's trying to identify. So the question is, if William Gilbert had actually committed these crimes, why would Postlewaite finger the appellant as opposed to William Gilbert? It's a stretch of imagination that someone would allow the real shooter to go free in order to convict somebody innocent. The problem that Martinez has with regard to saying that Postlewaite is just mistaken as to the identification of the person who jerked his head back is that the defense would then want both ways. Postlewaite is too drunk and is affected too much by the gunshot to his head to realize who this person was that's looking right at him and he shoots him. However, moments before, when he looks outside into the dark, he's able to see William Gilbert. So either his memories and faculties are totally shot, in which case you can't rely upon his identification of William Gilbert, identifying the opponent as the shooter. So Mr. Martinez decides to pursue the defense for why he says that Ronald Postlewaite can't remember anything. That as a result of drinking that night, he was shot in the head, he doesn't know who shot him. And that he's using this opportunity to settle the score with the Gillis brothers by identifying them as part of this group of people who rushed the house and committed these crimes. Therefore, he named them both in line as to both of the brothers. Therefore, the common defense is that neither brother was there, and Ron Postlewaite doesn't know who shot him, and he's making this all up. But that was the defense that was pursued at trial.
How did they explain the way the blood was found on Bill's jacket?
When Bill had showed up at the party, he got into a fight with the Oregons and got kicked out. And Wayne Gillard explained on the stand that during the fight that there was some blood probably got on his clothing. The trial court also analyzed the substitute defendant strategy and came to the conclusion that it was not a viable strategy in this case. And, excuse me, for a number of reasons, one of which, again, is this common defense would have been vitiated, and Ms. Martinette would have been left with trying to pursue an inconsistent approach to Postlewaite's identification. In addition, it puts the credibility of the defense case seriously at issue. If he's unable to convince the jury that William Gillard is the actual shooter, then his credibility on this point, as opposed to other points in the trial, is seriously damaged. It's one thing to say, I'm going to pursue an alibi defense, and thereby you're implying that someone else committed this crime. So in a sense, it's a general substitute defense. In this particular case, the appellant's arguing that not only should he have said someone else in the shooting, that the defendant also should assume the burden and point the finger at Bill Gillard. If the defendant is unable to meet that burden, again, he's going to suffer the credibility problem. Also, he's going to put the jury sympathy at stake as well in mitigation. Again, Ron Webb's testimony was that the appellant told him in response to the question about why he was in jail for these murders, was that he was taking the file for it. In other words, John Gillard was going to come and get his brother on the hook. He's going to let him sit in prison. He's going to take the call. Well, it's exactly what he would be doing by pursuing the substitute defense, is essentially forcing his brother to take the file for his crimes. If the jury, as it did in this case, had all this evidence, the circumstantial evidence, including William Gillard at the scene, the jury rejects that and still finds Postlewaite's identification is credible, and Ron Webb's testimony is credible, that the appellant was the one who fired the shots, I think you then run a serious risk of hurting your credibility and mitigation rate throughout.
Wouldn't there be a difference, though, in the advocacy level between a defense counsel saying, Bill did it, and here is all the evidence as to why Bill did it, not John, versus the state doing that? Because the state doesn't want the jury to believe Bill did it instead of John. They want the jury to believe John did it. So they're only using Bill to bolster John's guilt. There's a major difference between advocacy of those two different parties presenting that issue.
Well, I agree. There's also going to be some problems in trying to implement this substitute defendant defense. First off, all the evidence, again, linking Wayne Gillard to the house during the time of the crime was presented at trial. It was left for the jury to infer Wayne Gillard's involvement. Without Louis Martinez making the explicit point. Again, by Mr. Martinez in closing arguments, pointing this out and hammering and trying to make the point, again, he's putting his credibility at risk if the jury should find that no, it's not credible, the overwhelming way the evidence points to the
Counsel, may I go back to the original time, because I remember when I was going through this before, what was bothering me. I think we have said that when there is a conflict or an apparent conflict, one that is not just perceived but maybe to be real, whether the parties raise the issue or not, the trial court has a duty to move forward on that conflict. I struggled with that at the time because the conflict, as you were pointing out, is not as clear on the surface as where the adversary would make it. At least I didn't think so, but gave the benefit of the doubt to the defendant and sent it back. Was there any objection ever at the initial stage to Martinez continuing to represent both defendants? Did Martinez represent Bill in the trial court, in the municipal court, when he was charged with discharging a firearm?
Yes.
And nobody raised, so everybody knew that he was representing both of them?
That's correct.
And neither John or Martinez, nor the court, nor John's attorney raised the issue?
That's correct. The prosecutor.
Pardon?
It's the prosecutor who raises the issue.
Right.
When the defense calls, it's the way you can testify.
Okay. The prosecutor raised the issue, and then the trial judge went through all of this, didn't he?
Well, he appoints counsel for Wayne Gillard and Wayne Gillard. He doesn't address John Gillard's case, whether he's compromised by this joint representation.
You weren't the prosecutor that raised the issue, were you?
No.
I'm trying to say within the record, was the prosecutor's alarm cogent?
I think the concern was that actually that Mr. Martinez might satisfy Wayne Gillard's interest to protect Jones. And I think that's what the trial court focused on. That's why he appointed counsel, separate counsel, for Wayne Gillard, so that he would not incriminate himself in order to save his brother. So I think when you read the transcript, I think that's the flavor of the dialogue.
And no question about it, the trial judge was concerned about Bill Gillard, but at that time the issue was still there. What I was going to be charged with is discharging a firearm and something else, disorderly conduct, as I remember.
Right. I think one little twist in all this is a lot of these cases dealing with death, prosecutors deal with situations which you have co-defendants in joint trials. So you have a single lawyer representing two co-defendants sitting at the table at the time. So, and I think this is where Professor Kirkwood gets into his idea that the best defense is alibi and the substitute defendant. In that situation, you run the risk of sitting at the table with the co-defendant, whatever evidence wants to him, washing over onto you as well. And perhaps you want to look into your defense, not only being an absolute defense suit, but also pointing the finger at your co-defendant. In this case, you're going with a defendant that's being charged and tried separately by himself. Wayne Gillard is not charged as a defendant. His case, this trial, was resolved in municipal court. Again, one of the complexities of the case is that it was troublesome. The gang asked him who actually shot Leroy Ensign. Again, Postlewaite testifies that he hears this rush into the house and going to where he had left Leroy Ensign, and then there's a shot. And the next thing he does is throw himself on his fiancée's Bonnie's protector, and shortly thereafter he sees John Gillard driven that shooter. So it's a question of who actually killed Leroy Ensign. The ballistics, criminal or the bullet that killed Leroy Ensign was deformed, there was some problems with identification. But that was an issue right at the very beginning. And again, if you look at what evidence the police had initially, had Bill Gillard at the residence that night, getting into a fight with one of the victims, Leroy Ensign, having his nose bloody, and kicked out of the residence, therefore he had some motive to later come back and perpetrate the crimes they did, and also the Roy Porter, I'm sorry. John Postlane sees him outside firing his gun shortly before the herd rush into the house. So,
couldn't that then support the theory that Martin Nash should have argued that at least one of the people was shot by Bill, and that maybe John shot the other two just for witnesses? I mean, he could not have repressed one of them, right?
I'm not sure how that helps.
It's not a defense that I only killed two, huh?
Yeah.
Killed one and tried to kill the other one. Our argument would be, why did he kill these two people? Obviously, he was killing witnesses to the initial shooting. And again, we would argue that if we get a trial, that the time lapse between the shot to kill Leroy Anson and the defendant shooting closely was such a short span of time that
it was the state's theory, though, wasn't it, that Bill was there?
That's correct. That Bill Gilder was there, Timothy Hornbach was there, and John Gilder
was there. Yeah.
Did Timothy live yesterday?
No. He was also, all three were charged, and at the preliminary hearing, only John's case is found over to the grand jury. The case against Thornbach is dismissed, and substantively the case against Bill is dismissed. He pled to a city ordinance discharging a firearm within the city.
Do you know why Bill was arrested?
Did disappear. He was subsequently apprehended and charged with a form of these crimes, and he was tried. And I might add, as a result, as a condition of shock probation, he was ready to testify that.
So Tim has been convicted already?
Yes.
I didn't pick that up correctly.
So in conclusion, the trial court correctly ruled that there was not an actual conflict of interest in this case that adversely affected the appellant's defense in this case. And if this court should affirm the trial court's ruling and satisfy its independent duty under 29.29.05 to review the appellant's death sentences, which are not appropriate or disproportional in practice.
Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. Mr. Benza, you've saved about 12 minutes of your time.
Examination, it's specific.
counsel, if he doesn't even know that Lee Martinez is representing the substitute defendant. Don Wirtz identified from the very beginning of the investigation, he realized that there were two defenses. And Don Wirtz said that when he was there with John, they never talked about the conflict of interest. That was an issue that Louie decided, and he went with it. The fact is that Louie made the wrong choice. He couldn't see the conflict of interest. John Gillard now sits on death row. Bill Gillard played out the 4-3 misdemeanor. Subsequently, played out the aggravated burglary in his outlet. He asked the court to find that there was, in fact, an actual conflict of interest in this case. Reverse the case back to the common police court for a conflict of interest.
Thank you, Mr. Benza. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.